Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in BMG versus Peek.
Good morning, may it please the court. This is a class action case that, if tried, will require the trial court to put on the witness stand literally every plaintiff in this case to be asked whether or not he or she paid a late fee voluntarily.
Okay, I'm real confused. The voluntary payment rule, tell me whether you agree with this statement of what it is. Money voluntarily paid with full knowledge of all the facts and without fraud. Seems to me that if they prove they did not have full knowledge, the fraud, deception, duress piece goes away.
That's correct.
But the basic premise of your brief appears to be that even if they show no full knowledge, they also have to prove fraud.
Well, I think you've hit at the heart of the issue in the case. No, what our premise is that we have shown full knowledge.
Okay, all right, so you'd agree that if the knowledge issue is determined against you, then the rest of the individualized fraud piece goes away.
Okay. That's correct.
So just in terms of full knowledge, is it safe to say that your argument is if you know a late fee will be charged and you know the amount, that is full knowledge?
And the circumstances. In other words, as what happened here, if you don't pay within 30 days, then you will be charged a late fee.
Okay, so if you had in the agreements that interest at a certain amount would be charged on all overdue amounts, and that were paid for a period of time, and then it was determined after some time that that rate of interest was usurious, and the person paying it didn't know that it constituted usury, does he then pay with full knowledge?
Well, I'm not sure if the answer is yes, he pays with full knowledge. I don't know for sure if there wouldn't be some sort of separate statute that relates to usury that would apply, which you don't have here.
Is there a full knowledge defense to the usury?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Is there a voluntary payment defense to liquidated damages? Any case ever said, well, if you voluntarily paid the liquidated damages, you can't later claim it's a penalty?
I think that is accurate.
What? Which case says that?
The Salvaggio case, which is the 14th Court of Appeals case that we rely on, says that, and I think generally that is true with the voluntary payment.
I had trouble finding anything by this court regarding voluntary defense outside of taxes and one or two other limited areas. No. I mean, obviously, if you pay, you know, these fees that the car dealers always put on there, people always pay those voluntarily, and they always get them back because they're illegal fees. So I'm trying to find out where this voluntary payment defense is. All the time people pay a contract and then sue and get it back because the contract was breached or stuff like that. Which real cases do voluntary payments constitute a defense to?
Well, they do when there's full knowledge, and I think that's where the distinction arises here is was this full knowledge or not? And here the plaintiffs don't complain about about the method of how we provided knowledge. In other words, they don't complain that we limited it to the amount of the materials that was in. You know, we had it in our promotional materials, we had it in our invoices, we had it in our membership guide. Their sole contention is that we did not provide the basis for the late fee. In other words, how we reach the calculation of that late fee. So I think it limits the issue here in that case, whether that is required for there to be full
knowledge. What was the basis for the late fee?
We don't know. What the record doesn't reveal what the basis of the late fee was. And
if you don't know, how can we assume that they know?
Well, in this sense, what I mean is they don't know, but what they do know are the circumstances. They know the time, and they know the amount, and
that's
enough.
That's true of all the fees Judge Brister was talking about. I mean, you go to buy an automobile, and there's 30 things. You know, the price is $99.99, but
right,
there's
right,
30 things
right,
added on. You
right,
know you're
right.
paying them when you sign the financing.
But I think that's a different situation because those fees, they don't specify what those fees are for. Necessarily.
So they say this fee is for...
Document fee.
Yeah, and it turns out that's an illegal fee.
Right.
You're bound by the voluntary payment.
I think that's right.
Without,
yes.
So full knowledge doesn't mean knowing that it's something you don't have to pay.
That's correct.
So Lagio is a tax case, and so Lagio cites other precedents from this court on voluntary payment rule, and they all seem to be tax cases.
Right.
That are cited in Salvaggio. Frankly, I never heard of the voluntary payment rule until reading the petition for this case. I haven't been practicing this long as some of the folks here, but been around the block a few times. What is the origin and the rationale for the origin of the voluntary payment rule? Was it specifically to deal with governmental entities and tax payments, or was it for some other reason and it's been expanded?
I don't know if it was specifically meant to deal with tax cases, but I do know what the origin is and I do know what the basis is because there are numerous cases that talk about the policy reason behind the voluntary payment rule. And yes, you're correct, there are many, many cases where it involves taxes, but there are many other cases too where it involves late fees or other types of fees, and I'm talking about around the country. But the basis is that a person who is, the demand is made upon and then pays the fee, when they do that, they should have the responsibility then to dispute the fee and not, in a sense, sit on their rights and then later on leave themselves open to the option of being able to litigate, that they should do it up front. And then the payee should be entitled to be able to use that money and to know that he or she can use that money without fear that it is going to have to be returned later on.
So this rule then is based upon a rationale similar to estoppel.
I think that's exactly right. Similar to estoppel and sort of a practical one, that if you have a complaint, and there are cases that actually say this, if you have a complaint about the fee, then it is your responsibility to say up front, here is my complaint, not pay it, and then leave open the option of litigating.
So then the estoppel requirements about knowledge then might be imported into a view or an analysis or an understanding of the voluntary payment rule.
Well, right.
Perhaps.
That
may explain why there's a full knowledge requirement if it's an estoppel-based concept.
Right, and I would say it's analogous to estoppel. Maybe it is estoppel-based. I've never seen a case that specifically said it was estoppel-based. But surely fundamental to it and what may distinguish it best from the other type situations is what constitutes full knowledge and what has to be.
Let's get back to that. And I want to make sure, because I think the point of disagreement is a very narrow one, and that would be if for full knowledge you also need to know it's illegal, then you lose. Because I understand you've said that the threshold question about the extent and nature of each class member's knowledge of the late fees is susceptible to class-wide resolution. And all that we have to decide is what are the components of that knowledge. You say whether the payment is determined to be legal or illegal doesn't matter. They just have to know what the amount is.
I say that.
But if we say it does matter, they have to know that it's illegal,
right?
Then you lose.
I think that's right. Yes,
and
I agree.
And
that's
the
right.
Court in this case, that issue's not been determined. Under the certification order, the court will make that determination itself without, as a matter of law. That will not be a jury question. So this class will rise or fall on the trial court's determination as a matter of law of whether this payment is legal or illegal.
The trial court's determination as reviewed by the appellate courts. And I think as reviewed by the appellate courts now. And the reason that I say
But I guess what I'm saying is I'm getting away from the... We don't get to the individualized inquiry on whether it's a legal
right.
or illegal payment.
That's right.
And if the trial court decides that it is legal,
right.
they have no case. If the trial court decides that it's not legal, then there's a class. But so the class will rise or fall on this one determination.
It will. It may rise, but it may not fall. And by that I mean that if there is a determination that there was full disclosure, then the class fails. Because then the second prong of the voluntary payment rule has to kick in.
But you agree they didn't disclose it was illegal.
Well, I just, because we don't think it was illegal,
right,
Your
right.
Honor. But that issue is the basic issue in the merits of the
so
case.
So it's a very narrow.
Right.
And we can presume that everybody knew the law, which was that.
That's correct.
If it's a penalty, it's illegal, but if it's a rough estimation, it's okay.
Well, that's right.
Because that's what
either a rough estimation or if it is proper liquidated damages and if it's not a penalty.
How can you know if it's a rough estimate if you don't know or the company doesn't know the basis on which they calculate it?
Well, how can the person who's paying know
yes.
that?
How can I know that? Maybe because of bookkeeping and all, it cost them $20 to figure out a particular fact. Or maybe it only cost 50 cents because they have a good computer system.
Right. I think that they don't know if it is or if it isn't. But I don't think that they that it's required that they know that. In fact, there are cases that say if it is illegal, even if the fee is illegal, that the voluntary payment doctrine applies.
But so, I thought they had to have full knowledge.
So
and
then
full knowledge included that. Okay, so they.
The question is, what's full
knowledge?
They're
informed of the law. They know exactly what the standard is, even before we figure it out. And.
They may not. They don't know the law.
But,
they
don't, and so if they know that if it's a reasonable amount,
right.
they need to pay it. But if it's not a reasonable estimate of what the cost of processing a late payment is going to be, they don't have to pay it. But if they don't know the basis, even assuming this perfect knowledge of the law, if they don't know the basis for how to calculate it, I don't know how they can know.
Right.
I should pay this because it's going to be reasonable, or
how
I shouldn't
pay
it because it's illegal and these turkeys shouldn't be doing
what
it.
What do they do? Do they, I mean, the fee is assessed, and what do? They send a letter complaining this fee is an illegal fee. It doesn't represent a rough estimate of how much it would cost. And what basis would they have to even make that complaint?
Right.
Then they just kind of shove it all in your lap, and then you have to justify it, or how would that work?
Well, they could pay under protest.
Yeah, but
why
would they protest? If there's no basis for a protest.
Well, and there may not be. I mean, by your questions, I mean, you're assuming that this is an illegal fee, which we don't believe it's an illegal fee. And so to take it a step further, if it would almost require anyone who charges a fee to tell the full basis for the fee and why they think the fee is illegal. I mean, it really gets to the substance of the case to answer some of the questions, which are good questions, but to get to the substance of what you're asking. I mean, it presumes that the fee is illegal. And there shouldn't be any presumption that this fee is illegal. That's what would ultimately be decided in the trial court. And so if one says, well, we need to let them know the basis for whether it's illegal, then I think as a practical matter, that just makes it so difficult in any situation for someone who assesses any kind of a fee to know how much information has to be put on there. I think there needs to be enough to put the payor on notice that if they, of the circumstances, the time, the amount, what we did here, and that should be enough to put them on notice to at least inquire, to pay under protest, to investigate, and ultimately to file suit if they think it's appropriate to file suit. But the key problem in going back to your question, Justice O'Neill, and how this kind of fits into this whole class action concept, I think it's really a two-step process. Number one, of course, the court has to determine whether there is full knowledge, and that's what we've been talking about. If the court, just so you understand our position, if the court determines there was not full knowledge, then this class is certifiable.
Okay, let me ask you this question. Let's say the class definition was all those who paid this fee under protest.
Right.
Voluntary payment rule would not apply.
I think that's correct.
Appropriate for class certification.
I think that's correct. That's correct. But of course, as your question indicates, that's not what happened here. So what does have to happen, and I think for the difficult question involved in this case, is that there has to be a determination then made, and how does that fit into the overall concept of determining when a class action is appropriate to be certified and when it's not. Because there does have to be a legal determination made, was this full disclosure, before you even get to step number two. And of course, generally, the court does, you don't make in the class action decision whether to certify the class a substantive legal determination. But here, that has to be done. Not the substantive legal determination back whether there's liability or not, but the substantive legal determination of whether there is full disclosure. Because that is so inherent in the decision of whether the predominance requirement is met. And you have what is truly, I believe, a bogus argument about whether this is full disclosure or not. There's not been any case in the country, and we cited, and as it turns out, ironically, in both footnote 4 of both our opening brief and our response, we cited case after case that says that this argument on full disclosure is not, that it requires stating the basis, that does not defeat full disclosure.
But disclosure doesn't matter if it's determined that it's illegal.
Oh, it doesn't matter. No, I disagree with that. Because the voluntary payment doctrine applies even if the demand is illegal.
And the question we have to decide is, does the payer have to know it's illegal or not? You say it doesn't.
It does.
They say it does. If we say the payer does have to know it's illegal, you lose.
But the thing that's so troubling about the question, as you phrase it, is that presumes it's illegal. And in fact, if you presume it's illegal, then in fact what the court's doing is substantively deciding an issue in the case that it's illegal.
But
and
we're
I know
doing the same thing, mirror image, if we decide that it is legal and bust the class. In other words, the whole class will rise or fall on this determination.
It will rise.
Both factually and legally. I mean,
whether there should be a class or not, is that's correct. But there won't be a class either way. And in one situation, there will be a class, and that is if there's not full disclosure. If there is full disclosure, then there cannot be
a
class.
But whether it's legal or illegal is a common issue.
That's true.
And we have to just decide as a matter of law as to whether the payer has to know that fact for the voluntary payment rule to apply.
That's correct, and I think what you'll find is there are many, many cases throughout the country that have said, and no cases to the contrary, that say that that's not a requirement.
Thank you, Counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bruce Kennedy will present argument for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. I think the court has zeroed in on exactly what the issue is in this case. There is no contest as to the certifiability of these claims except as it relates to this voluntary payment defense. Justice Jefferson had asked what the purpose of their late fee was, and it's clear.
Counsel, before we get there, would you agree that in order to determine whether predominance exists, we have to know what the law is that's going to apply to the case?
I do, Your Honor. I believe that's correct, and I think in the Hankins case.
Well, let me ask another question to focus you in on what I'd like to ultimately get to. The trial court said the voluntary payment rule doesn't apply here. The underlying rationale doesn't fit this case. It's unlikely it's going to apply. The Court of Appeals said it is, quote, far from clear, close quote, that the voluntary payment rule applies. Neither court determined that the voluntary payment rule applies. Are the parties knowledgeable about something that's not in the Court of Appeals opinion or the trial court order? Is the voluntary payment rule going to apply to this case? Isn't that our first question?
Actually, Your Honor, I believe that is a merits determination that needs to be made once the certification issue is resolved. And I can explain that.
You just agreed with me that we have to know what the law is to determine whether certification was proper or not. Now you said we should confirm the certification and send that back to the trial court to determine what the law is.
No, I believe as this court determined in the Hankins case, you have to make some merits analysis of the issues to see how it applies to the facts of the case, to the claims being made. We're not disputing that at all. But as the court also said, the merits analysis at certification is far less searching than in trial on the merits, and it certainly isn't a determination on the issue of the merits. What both the trial court and the Beaumont Court of Appeals says is the allegation is being made by the class that the voluntary payment defense does not apply in this case. That may be may be the case. It may be that it does apply, but its application or non-application, based on the law as it is a determination that will have to be made on the merits. They recognize the issue. They had analyzed the facts surrounding it, but simply did not make that determination because it was not the appropriate stage to make the determination.
Well, we may be talking about two different things. Whether the law of a voluntary payment rule applies to this case is a different issue from whether the facts establish a violation of that rule. I'm just curious as to why neither court would say that it applies or would say clearly that it doesn't apply.
Perhaps I can answer it this way. From the class's perspective, there are three separate distinct arguments for why it would not apply. Okay? First one being under the McClung case. That's the Dallas Court of Appeals case from 72 dealing with the voluntary payment. The court there said that the voluntary payment doctrine is not rigidly applied where the reasons underlying the rule are not present. And the only reason underlying the rule it stated was that by delaying bringing a claim, a payee may be put at a disadvantage because of the unavailability of records or witnesses. And the McClung court there determined that there wasn't any such hardship, and they didn't apply the voluntary payment rule. Second reason is also from the McClung court, where the court says, what we have to do in this case, because this was a case involving a large bale of cotton, left at a gin, it wasn't reweighed at the appropriate time. There was a dispute over the lost market value and also a separate claim related to storage costs that had been paid. And the court in McClung says, we have a dichotomy here between this voluntary payment rule and the rule that says a party who suffers a breach of contract is entitled to full damages as compensation. And where those two rules conflict, we're going to decide that the rule in favor of full compensation for breach of contract prevails over the voluntary payment. So that's the second reason why the voluntary payment rule doesn't apply. And the third reason gets back to what you're discussing with the underlying rationale for the rule itself. Frankly, I think rather than estoppel, a closer analogy to the voluntary payment defense is laches.
Laches.
Yeah, that old chestnut. It's one where someone is put at a disadvantage because of delay. The only rationale presented for the defense being applicable by BMG in this case was fairness and finality. Here we have a situation where they have admitted they have lost no records. There's no indication that any of the evidence they would need to defend this case is missing, misplaced, unavailable to them. So the rationale for the rule is not applicable.
And Southwest Industries versus Borneo, Houston Court of Appeals says that it's essentially an estoppel-based concept. So there's a number of different theories out there.
Right, and which is frankly, and there was some discussion about the tax cases, it's almost like there are two separate animals out there. There's a voluntary payment defense as it relates to taxing authorities, which is based on more, as some of the courts have said, on sort of a sovereign immunity type issue, more of an efficient method of revenue collection for taxing authorities. And then there's the private sector voluntary payment rule, which is very seldom applied. And in the Texas cases that they cited, for instance, the McClung case that we've talked about, it was not applied at all. In the Salvaggio case was a tax case, and it was tried as related to the duress element to get around the defense. Same with the Spring Branch Bank case was a duress case. Runcie versus Runcie, the court specifically found that the plaintiff was familiar with all the facts, which was the same thing in the Boyd case. Evidence shows the plaintiff was familiar with all the facts. And in Southwestern Industrial that the court just mentioned, the plaintiff did not allege he was ignorant of any facts. So those cases that have applied it in Texas are separate and distinct from the case we're presented with here, which gets back to the nature of the claims, which goes back to the purpose that they had in charging the late fee, where their representative admitted that the primary purpose for the late fees was to incent our members to pay. In other words, it was a penalty clause to induce performance of a contract. As we know, you can't get punitive damages for breach of contract. And what this court has said in the Phillips versus Phillips case is that enforcement of a penalty, like enforcement of an illegal contract, violates public policy. It shouldn't.
Let me ask you about the voluntary. If we were to determine that, let's presume the penalty, let's presume this is an illegal penalty, the late fee. If we were to hold that that Mr. Peek did not need to know that when he paid for the voluntary payment rule to apply, would you agree that determination of the fraud, deception, coercion, duress piece would devolve into a particularized inquiry that would defeat commonality?
No, and here's why, just so Neil. First of all, you're right in that the knowledge is the key that the class is relying upon here to defeat. If the defense is applicable, the knowledge element is the one that the class is relying upon to defeat the defense. I don't think it has to go so far as to say that they send you a letter saying, we're charging you an illegal fee. I think what it requires is full knowledge of the facts, and the facts underlying.
What does that mean?
Well, what that means is, as the questioning earlier reflected, in order to determine if it's meets the Phillips test of a proper liquidated damages provision versus a penalty, you have to know first, were the actual damages difficult or impossible to estimate prior to breach? There's no evidence here that they were.
How are you going to put all that in this notice or in this invoice?
Well, it's actually quite simple, because in a number of the cases from around the country that they cited, that's exactly what happened. For instance, in the Dillon case out of New York, the defendant had made a pre-charge calculation and notified everybody about it, and that's why voluntary payment.
What did he say? I'm just curious. Do you attach a financial statement, or?
I don't think it's that necessary. I think something that says, you know, we're charging this fee based upon our calculation estimate of the damages to be suffered.
Now, if that statement's true, then you can't recover no matter what.
If the statement that they included there.
If that statement's true, you can't recover.
If that's right. If they have made a reasonable estimation.
And if that statement's false, then the voluntary payment rule doesn't apply because there's no full disclosure. So it seems to me that if that's the rule, there isn't a voluntary payment. Because either way, it's going to come out the same way either way.
No, it's certainly, if they honestly disclose all of the facts to their members.
Then you can't. I mean, they're not going to say, we're charging you an illegal fee. So they're going to say, we're charging you a fee based on what it really costs. Okay? That's what you say they should say. Something like that.
Yeah.
If that statement's true, then you have no case.
That's true.
And if the statement is false, the voluntary payment rule doesn't apply.
That's true.
So either way, if that's the requirement of the voluntary payment rule, there is no voluntary payment. It doesn't affect the outcome.
The reason that the first outcome is the way it is because on the merits of the claim, we lose. Because then they have a proper liquidated damage clause under Phillips versus Phillips.
I know, but it seems to me that the purpose of the voluntary payment rule is to say you're not going to recover when otherwise you might on the merits. Isn't that the purpose of it? Otherwise, it doesn't have a purpose.
Well, that's what I keep coming back to. It's really unclear as it relates to the private sector what the underlying purpose of the voluntary payment defense is, other than to prevent prejudice.
Whether it's latches or estoppel or whatever it is, the effect of the rule is to keep somebody who has a good claim from recovery.
That's the way it's attempted to be applied, yes.
And it seems to me if the disclosure has to be what you say it does, then it would never apply, and there's no point in having it.
If the court wants to abrogate the voluntary payments defense rule, I would sign on to that. But
let me ask, how many people are in your class?
Based on the discovery responses that were done prior to this certification hearing, it's unclear. There were approximately a little over 200,000 late fees collected each of the 4 years prior. So there's probably some overlap in there. So it's safe to say there's several hundred thousand. But until we get this,
let's say half a million.
That's probably right.
Probably a law professor in there somewhere, right? Perhaps even a member of your firm in there somewhere.
I don't think so.
Perhaps there's a member of a firm who has filed just claim just like this against Blockbuster. They would know that there's a good risk chance that this $1.50 flat fee is a penalty, right?
It depends, because
if they just purely hypothetical, if they filed a claim just like yours, then when they got this $1.50 fee, they would know there's a good chance it's probably a penalty. And, of course, if there's one in the class, then how are we going to find them if it's a class?
I understand what the court is asking. You're asking about, then, the duress, the coercion, the fraud?
No. Let's assume out of this half a million, there are 10 people who really would be subject. They don't need any disclosure at all. They know exactly when they get this $1.50 flat rate that there's no way that that could be based on what the carrying cost was. How do we find those people in a class action? And doesn't the defendant have a right to cross-examine all half a million if they want to find those 10 people so they can kick them out?
I don't think so, because you're basically asking to find 10 people who have some knowledge that the defendant itself didn't have, because they didn't make the calculation.
No, they say they didn't calculate. They can't say exactly how much it costs to pay a late fee, you know, for everybody that's late. But that doesn't mean necessarily that it either is or is not. I mean, if it's just, I mean, as we said in the Phillips case, if it said, you know, three times what your actual damages are, you don't have to know what the actual damages are to know that's a penalty. If it said $1.50, whether you're 1 day late or 100 days late, we don't have to know what the calculation is, because it's not based on how long you waited.
That's not what their fee was. Their fee was $1.50.
You're quibbling with me over the details of my hypothetical.
I'm really trying not to, Justice Brister. I just don't understand how those people have that knowledge. They may have an assumption, they may have a belief, but they're not going to have that knowledge, because it's possible that a $1.50 fee would be a reasonable estimate.
For everybody, for all 5 million people, no matter when they, whether they pay the day after they get the notice or 29 days later, no matter how many times they've been contacted, no matter whether they live in Thailand or Temple, $1.50 is always going to be a good estimate.
I'm sorry, I just don't know how to answer that question other than to say I don't know how they'd have that knowledge.
I guess the definition is problematic to me, because you all seem to agree that the cases in Texas agree on a definition of what it is. It seems to me that within the definition is the concept that if you have to know all the facts, but you don't have to know that it's a void or illegal demand or upon a claim which had no foundation in fact. In other words, you pay it, and you can't get it back if you paid it, even if the claim had no foundation in fact or it was illegal. I mean, that's what the definition seems to say.
That is what the definition seems to say, but then that, like the McClung court dealt with the conflicting rules, because in Phillips versus Phillips, we said it should not be done, referring to collection of a penalty, it should not be done even if the parties do not object. So you've got conflicting rules of law here, it seems, and in the application where there isn't full disclosure of the facts, obviously, the phrase in the definition that you're reading, with knowledge of all the facts, must mean something. So there must be a determination made as to whether or not the facts were known.
Let me ask you, in the reply brief at pages 5 and 6, the petitioner says, every case BMG Direct was able to locate addressing the issue whether the person making the charge must disclose the late fee, holds that there is no obligation to make such a disclosure in order to obtain the benefits of the voluntary payment rule. And those cases were also cited in the brief, the initial brief. You didn't respond to those in the response.
The cases from out of state?
Well, they're cited in footnote 4, I think.
In footnote 4, yes, those are the cases from out of state. Basically, what we have there is a situation where, for instance, there were two cases from Mississippi, the Hill and the Horn case. If you read the definition that those courts cite for the Mississippi voluntary payment rule, there isn't a clause that says it has to be based on knowledge of all the facts. So there isn't that requirement. Moreover, the Horn case was a duress claim. So that's what that was ruling at. In the Hill case, the Hill case in Mississippi, the court had actually certified the case and then later on ruled on the merits as to the voluntary payment defense. They didn't find it to be a bar certification. Same way with the Oklahoma case, McWelty. The plaintiff there pled that class had full knowledge of all the facts. We talked about the New York case, the Florida case, the Hall case dealt with a very specific statute on voluntary payment relating to these hospital payments that were being made.
You say they're distinguished.
They are distinguished. And because
in your brief at footnote 2, you say you cite some cases that were tried. You say they were tried in sort of this context. And the response brief says they don't mention the voluntary payment doctrine.
The ones that I mentioned as being tried did not, which were simply mentioned for one reason alone. They say that every place else in the country that has ever dealt with this late fee litigation bounces it because of the voluntary payment defense. Clearly, that's not the case in those cases, in those states where it's actually been tried, in District of Columbia, in Maryland, in California, in Pennsylvania, where the certification the lack of certification by the trial court was reversed as an abuse of discretion. The other out-of-state cases that we cited, the Muncy case from Louisiana, the Hansen case from Minnesota, the Pratt case from Tennessee, and the Folsom case from Georgia, all dealt with the voluntary payment defense and rejected it.
I'm frankly not sure I understand the disclosure argument. Tell me if I've got this right, because that seems to me to be a kind of a side issue. I mean, the fee is either legal or it's illegal. And my understanding about where the disclosure piece comes in on the voluntary payment defense is, if it's illegal, the only way the voluntary payment defense would apply would be if in the agreement itself you revealed that it was illegal, or at least enough information from which the payer could determine that it was illegal. Would it be accurate to say that that's the only context in which this disclosure, failure to disclose argument has any meaning?
Actually, in one other area, because they have now acknowledged that knowledge component of the voluntary payment defense can be tried on a class-wide basis as a common issue. But then they step back and say, however, we're going to win that argument, and therefore that leaves you with duress, fraud, and coercion, and those are all individualized. That's really a straw man argument that's easy to knock down, because here you're dealing with a situation where they admit they had uniform contacts with each and every one of the class members through their promotional material.
Maybe my question is more, when I first started reading the briefing, I became confused on the nature of the class claims, because my understanding of, and maybe it was just me, but it seemed to me that the class question was whether they disclosed or didn't disclose financial information. And that was a more difficult concept for me than just the simple legal determination of whether this is a legal or an illegal fee. And so, is it accurate to say that the claim in this case is that an illegal fee was charged, and the only way the voluntary payment defense could be gotten around in this agreement would be if they had made full disclosure of how the fee was calculated that showed it was illegal on its face, then if Peak had paid it anyway, voluntary payment rule would apply?
That's accurate, with the addition of the three reasons for completely avoiding the defense that I talked about with Justice Wainwright. But if the defense applies, that's the only way for the class.
So disclosure is not really the issue so much as legal or illegal fee.
Well, I think the way the defense is worded is that the class members have to have knowledge of all the facts And as we've talked about, the facts that they have to have knowledge of would lead one to the conclusion, one way or the other, would give a basis for determining whether it was a legal or illegal fee.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Judge O'Neill, if I may, let me begin by addressing your question. And as I understand it, the issue that you raise is how important, or isn't it fundamental, to determine whether this fee was legal or illegal? And the answer to that is that it is not. And the reason for that is that the voluntary payment rule almost presumes that it's illegal. Now, that's not to say it's illegal in our case, but it presumes it's illegal because there's no need for it unless the demand is illegal. Because if you pay something that you're supposed to pay, that's legally paid, then there's no point of having the defense at all.
Well, it seems to me, based on the estoppel argument, the purpose of the voluntary payment rule is if you pay something knowing it's illegal, if you pay something knowing you shouldn't be charged it, but you pay it anyway, then you really sort of waive the right to complain.
But you do not now have to know it's illegal. I think that's the next step in the analysis, that there is no requirement. You need to know the facts, but you don't need to know that they are illegal. And there are many cases that say that. I have a particularly good one, which we cite in footnote 4 is the Putnam case, and it relies on some of the other cases that we cite in footnote 4. And it's a case out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It says that the customer's failure to know the precise factors underlying Time Warner's decision to charge a $5 late fee is not a mistake in fact as to the basis for the payment made, nor is it the product of fraud by omission. And here's the point. To conclude otherwise would tacitly suggest that all demands for payment in business transactions would need to be accompanied by an itemized list explaining the basis for each charge so that the payor had voluntary knowledge. It's just not required. And so that, I think that's the fundamental point.
Well, let me ask you this. It seems superficially, without the voluntary payment rule, that this would be the perfect case that class actions are designed to address, and that is no individual plaintiff would ever file suit for $1.50.
Right.
If, in fact, it were illegal, no one would ever challenge it unless it was done on a class-wide basis. So, but for this voluntary payment defense, you'd agree that it is just, in its subject matter, one that is typically used as a paradigm for a class action suit.
Yes, but the voluntary payment rule is an awfully big obstacle, and we have the right to have a rigorous analysis of predominance judged on our defenses, which this court has said repeatedly, on our defenses, not just on the claims. And so this is, in fact, I think, a case that will show why that rigorous analysis is so important. And in looking at the defenses, because one of the arguments or one of the bases for the application of the predominance requirement to defenses, too, is that, in fact, what may well happen, and I think what would happen in this case, is whenever you put all these individuals on the stand and you ask them, did you pay this because you were forced to, basically, or you were defrauded, or you were deceived, the answer is going to be no. And so we're going to, I predict, win, if we'd ever got to that point, we would win our case. And I'm not trying to go outside the record just as much as to say how this might play out.
We never adopted this rule in this court for this state. And why is it a good idea to have a voluntary payment rule if, as you say, the whole purpose behind it is a fee is that has been charged as illegal and a claim is brought within some applicable statute of limitations period? Why is this good public policy for the state?
Well, it's good public policy for the state before the voluntary payment rule to apply, because that the money sort of enters into the stream of commerce, if you will. People obtain the money, and they should be able to go on and spend that money. Because if they are, in fact, doing something illegal or are wrong, it gives them the opportunity to cure that. And it should be incumbent on the person who has a complaint to say, here's my complaint, here's the problem, here's the demand. Change it, which the person, the payee, may do. And if not, then someone should complain first and litigate second. And so those, I think, are the public policy reasons behind having this. They're good public policy reasons. They're recognized universally around the country and should be recognized.
And so when the customer gets that bill for $2.50 or right. whatever it is, they cannot pay it and send, say, give me all your financial data that backs this up so I can determine whether it's financially reasonable. And then the company is going to, this is going to cause them to go reassess their policy and determine whether it's legal or not.
Well, they can call and ask. It's possible. They can call and ask why, or they can say, I'm not going to participate anymore unless you do something about this fee. And then if enough people are upset about the fee for business reasons, they may change it, if for no other reason, even if it's a legal fee. So, yes, I think it could make a difference. These companies get thousands and thousands, millions, literally, of calls from people about these, and some of those calls are, well, you know, may well and probably are complaining about the fee and trying to seek information about the fee, and they may end up satisfied that it's a legitimate fee under the circumstances.
The trial court certification order says that after it determines that it's unlikely the voluntary payment doctrine would apply, it says even if it does apply, it appears from the evidence presented by plaintiff that the issue is not individual and may be determined as another common issue on a class-wide basis. I understand there was no live testimony taken at the certification hearing. Is that correct? There were affidavits and depositions and argument of counsel and briefing. What was the evidence that, I know you can't cite it all, or maybe you can, memory, but generally, what was the evidence the trial court relied on to make that determination? I assume it's in our record.
Well, the short answer is I don't really know. I mean, you're asking what evidence, because I think the trial court reached the wrong conclusion. My presumption in reading that is that the trial court made the decision that there wasn't full disclosure and was really making a legal decision that they didn't count this as full disclosure. I can't say because I'm just reading the opinion and looking at the evidence in the same way that the court is.
So you would assume that the trial court determined that failure to reasonable approximation of damages does not foreclose use of the voluntary payment tool. The trial court
determined that it was foreclosed because there was not full disclosure.
Are there any cases that so hold? You've cited in the briefing a number of cases in other states,
right,
not Texas,
right,
that hold in your favor. Are there any cases that go the other way? I know your opposing counsel has distinguished or attempted to distinguish your cases, but are there any cases that purport to hold for the respondent?
No. There are no other cases. And make sure I've got the right issue. There are no other cases that hold that the basis for the payment has to be disclosed or the legality of the payment has to be disclosed. There is not a single other case. And the cases that are in support of that position we cite in footnote 4.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments. Marshall will adjourn the court.
All rise.